I just wanted to bring into the conversation Mr. Sanjay Puri also. I've been sort of disingenuous that I didn't bring this up earlier. Mr. Puri is the chairman of the U.S. Indian Political Action Committee. He's the founder and the CEO of the Optimus Incorporated, an information technology company. Mr. Puri received his MBA in finance from George Washington University School of Business. And Mr. Puri, the question that sort of comes up is a relationship between Pakistani Americans, Indian Americans, and the policymakers in the U.S. We have a great example of two neighbors, United States of America and Canada, living in great harmony, political harmony, social harmony, economic harmony. And they have been, the U.S. has been able to expand that to Mexico also, so there is a... The thought that comes to mind is that could there be common grounds where we could work together, how could we bring this out in a relationship that actually helps the process over the long run, so that we are a sort of an engine of change rather than conflict? And maybe if you could sort of highlight some of your thoughts and maybe we could get that little discussion going.
Well, thank you for having me here. I'm sure a lot of people are wondering. When I got the request also, I was wondering why they wanted me here, especially on Diwali Day. I thought it was a joke, but anyway, that's a whole different story. But I think it's a very important forum, and I'm truly glad and obviously to be here with Congressman Tierney and the respectable ambassador. I do have a question and a comment, because I'm here also to learn myself, because, you know, ignorance is bliss. And if you don't hear all viewpoints, you can only have an ignorant viewpoint. So, you know, in India, people talk about the IITs and others of the world, but they forget the real education that has happened is what the United States really sees. I mean, Harvard is a great institution.
Could you keep the mic closer to you?
Yeah, very proud of it. But it's the community colleges and the technical institutions in this country that have really been a big, big difference for our nation, the United States. Is there the infrastructure in Pakistan? Because I can tell you, in India today, there's a need for 10,000 community colleges, because if you take a mason or a carpenter and give him 6 months of professional training, you add almost 60% income to that person's life. So it's the whole example of teaching a person to fish, et cetera. But so I don't know if that infrastructure exists, because everybody focuses on having these preeminent institutions, which we need to have. But look around the United States and see the role the community colleges are, and see the enrollments that have jumped, not just in major institutions, but in community colleges because of the downturn in economy. So I think that's a discussion that should be had in Pakistan in terms of education, because it's worked in India. Obviously, there were still a lot of challenges. Coming to the point of Indian Americans and Pakistani Americans, again, I don't speak for the government of India. I want to make that very, very clear. I'm a U.S. Citizen, have been here for a long period of time, and our members are all American citizens. I think there are certain myths that Indian Americans have, and there are certain myths that Pakistani Americans have, and I think a dialogue like this helps. I think the first myth, obviously, that a lot of people probably have is that Indian Americans are against aid to Pakistan. I don't, at least the ones that I talk, and like I said, I talk to a lot. Every Indian American wants a stable Pakistan, not just for the sake of Pakistan or for the sake of India, but also for the sake of the United States, but more for global peace, prosperity. And I think that's a fact that goes across the board with most Indian Americans. And I think what the Congressman just talked about, education, it's a very important factor. And I think the dialogue has to happen, and Indian Americans need to challenge, and we do, the policies of India. Same thing, I think Pakistani Americans need to at times challenge when they see that they don't agree, because everything that we see or represented is not always how it is. And we need to, Indian Americans need to do that more, and we do in our own way, not maybe as often as we do. But I think Pakistani Americans need to do that. And maybe personally we have such great ties, but sometimes ideologically we fall maybe on different ties, and maybe I think the next generation is going to be very, very different. I think that's where I think you'll see major, major differences happen.
I'm sure people have questions in the audience. So please come to the mic and... And I would, just to set some rules up, let it be a short question, and let's have a discussion with the our esteemed guests, and let it be very sort of cordial.
Thank you very much, and I want to congratulate the organizers to arrange such a... Thank all the organizers for arranging this meeting. I'll try to be as quick as possible, as Nadeem said. I just wanted to bring attention to another group of physicians that are doing a little bit of this medical education for physicians in Pakistan. It's the group that's called MERIT, Medical Education and Research Committee, that the chairperson, Dr. Naeem Subhani, could not be here today. She's also from Boston. I'm involved in that. Dr. Wali Khan is involved in that. And what we do is we take physicians of Pakistani origin who are trained here and take them to Pakistan to train specifically physicians and maybe medical students at the same time. And it's been working well, and Dr. Afridi has been involved in training SELS and CPR courses there as well. And that was for information. My question to the congressman was that is there any kind of support that this specific group can get for that purpose, to educate the physicians? Thank you.
I didn't get to hear all of that. You might want to repeat it.
Yes. So the question that you're asking, Khalil, is that how do you re-educate the Pakistani physicians? I see. So there is a particular program going on called the MERIT program, and the question is that would there be some support in terms of trying to build that program up in terms of sort of a U.S. policy initiative, that's from that perspective?
I don't know of any particular emphasis on that at this point in time. I'm sure within the resources that are given, we're trying to leave that flexibility for the Pakistani government. If they want to take advantage of it that way and try to work a cooperative effort out, I'm sure there'd be great sentiment for doing that. We have a sentiment from private groups also working in that direction, but I know of no individual policy initiative already targeted just solely to that. The resources were given more broadly to be shaped by the people that are making policy decisions.
Tom?
Yeah, this is not, perhaps a tangent, but related to that. One of the things you're addressing really is sort of the capacity issue. And Dr. Juma raised that in his initial comments, this issue of severe capacity limitations, whether it's physicians in particular, but other groups. And I think that one of the challenges is going to be for Pakistan or any country, as well as the United States, in terms of this is some of these issues around comparative effectiveness and what that means in terms of evaluating. And what we're doing in South Africa and many of these other centers of excellence are trying to figure out what is the right relationship or ratio of physicians, nurses, physician extenders, community health workers, and what those roles can be in terms of expanding a minimum package? Because it's clear that the number of physicians in Pakistan, even if there's a few more trained, is not going to be enough to offer a minimum package to the entire population of healthcare. And so trying to come up with ways to evaluate at what level, first of all, how many and what the ratios are, and what level of training would be required to do the different facets of providing a public health care package to the majority of the population.
Not that I want to revisit health care in the United States right now. I'm sort of enjoying a little respite
here
today. But obviously that is part of the bill that we're working on, is trying to get the right mix for ourselves. It's not that we've actually become experts in that. We're still struggling to find out how many primary care workers we need, how many physician assistants, how many specialists on that, and ways to get them through the pipeline quickly enough so that they can have an impact on servicing it. So I'm sure we'll be working on that issue together.
And this is why I say it's a two-way street. In this particular case, I think these studies that are being done globally are going to help the United States and other high-income countries determine what is the most effective system. We're struggling with that, but as well as the staffing, the capacity that's necessary. I just want to add the other point. My first degree was from West Virginia University. It's a state university. So I think that's a vital part of the infrastructure. You don't need elite universities. You need to give the mass of the population some level of education. I'll leave it to you to decide what level that is and how to deliver it. But I completely agree with you that that's important.
Is Dr. Juma online? I just wanted to get his perspective on it. Is or have they?
Naveen, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, Naveen, I just wanted to go back to what the congressman was talking about earlier, and that's the Kerry Lugar bill and the opportunities it provides. And I think that he's absolutely correct in saying that this does afford Pakistan a tremendous opportunity. You know, just to put it into perspective, I wish I'd come prepared with the figures, but, you know, that entire amount of $1.5 billion is about what Pakistan's total public sector development is for a year. And I can tell you that trying to fund that public sector development has put the government of Pakistan under great strain in the last financial year, and even in this financial year, it's looking like it's going to be a problem. So the assistance to the social sector that this bill affords, this is non-military assistance, actually gives Pakistan tremendous space. And I really do believe, and I'm not being an apologist for the government, but I really do believe that it is such an opportunity that the people who feel that the thunder may fall before the government for bringing in such a major change troubles them. And so a lot of the noise that you're hearing against the assistance relates actually to people worrying that this may bring about a sea change, and because a lot of this is actually going to be targeted at 25 highly deprived districts of Pakistan in all four provinces. But having said that, Congressman, I must very quickly say that even for somebody who did anticipate this, the language of the bill is really quite offensive in part. But having said that, can I also say very quickly that the great challenge is going to be of how to actually get that assistance translated into programs that create impact over time. And this is not easy. One of the good things that I can see that the State Department has done is to send out Mrs. Robin Rafael, who has a lot of experience with Pakistan. I think her heart is in this job because of her background and associations with Pakistan. And she's a very bright lady. And she has spent a lot of time talking to people, trying to get a sense of what it is that we can do that will create the kind of impact that we all desire. That specific question, Naveen, there are two ways of addressing that. The merit program sounds like a good program. The one thing they could do is to approach the USAID office, and I would point them to one of the senior officers there who deals with Pakistan, Mrs. Gloria Steele, who's always looking for good ideas to pass down the chain. But the other way of doing it is to approach the health ministry in Pakistan, and we would then partner with Merit and put it forward as our program. So if your questioner wants to go down that route, he's most welcome. And Naveen, you know, through you, we can be in touch.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Juma. I would take one more question from that side, and let it be other than medicine.
Okay, so... I'm Nabil Zafar. I'm from Pakistan. I just got here. I'm studying master's in public health from the Harvard School of Public Health. My question is on the theme of the conference about security and how soft measures like education and health can help with that. And I'm kind of confused, actually baffled, as to the disparity of the tone with the relations between Pakistan and America. When it comes to military might, it's we always hear things like, you're with us or against us, or you have to do this and you have to do that. When it comes to education and health, it's good if you do this, it's good if you do that, and we'll support you and you can do that. But if education and health is such a strong priority for security of the United States and the development of Pakistan, then why isn't the stance between the relations between Pakistan and America more assertive in the sense that you do this and we will do this for you. You increase the literacy rate and we'll give you more aid, or we'll decrease your loans and you have to do this. So that my question is to you, Mr. Congressman, why isn't this that? And to Dr. Jumma, is that kind of stance encouraged in Pakistan related to health and education? Thank you.
I need you to, I'm having a very difficult time hearing, so I need you to just sort of give me the definition of that question, because all I'm hearing is noise, I'm sorry.
Right. So essentially, if I understand you correctly, the question is, when it comes to military aid, or when it comes to military intervention, it's a very strong emphasis and from the U.S. government. When it comes to real issue development or human development in Pakistan, then it's left to the people to negotiate and discuss. And he wanted to know, why was that discrepancy?
Well, I tell you, first of all, it isn't entirely left on that. As you understand, we took $75 million and targeted specifically to education to make sure that that's where it was spent. So there are times when we want to really make a point, and I actually had quite a bit of opposition doing that. The people just didn't want to put those kind of constraints on it because they were afraid to get the reaction that they've gotten with the conditions that we put on the military money. But I also have to say it's the problems that we perceive with the military and their idea of whether or not the terrorists were an existential threat to Pakistan or not were seen to be a lot larger than any disagreements we had in terms of money going to development and education and health care. There seemed to be general agreement amongst the civilian government as to the need to spend those monies in those areas and a cooperative effort as to how they were going to be spent. We just needed to get more resources there, and then we're going to have considerable oversight on that. And that's one of the issues that my committee deals with, is how do we make sure as we're going from year to year that this expense is worth it. There are requirements in the statute that the president report back to us as what the results of these monies are. You know, is the money going where we thought it was? Are they having results or things moving along in the development on that? But there's a perceived agreement, at least between the civilian government of Pakistan and the policymakers in Washington, that they want to invest in education, they want to invest in health care, they want to do things with their energy system and other development. And we're trying to work cooperatively with them. But when we think that things are going astray, as we did with the education issue, when we thought that there weren't enough schools being created that gave people an alternative to the madrasas that we thought were, you know, madrasas concentrating too heavily on the extreme religious aspects, we then targeted the $75 million and said, look, we need you to do something here, and there's the money. We're not going to, you know, tell you how to do it exactly every school by school, but that's education money. That's what we want to invest in and see move along in that direction. So if the president reports back to us that, you know, this money on the civilian side just isn't going to anything constructive on that, when it comes time to reauthorize, you know, there'll be some serious issues there. But we don't perceive any real divergence from the civilian government of Pakistan in terms of a desire to invest the money in education and health care and in energy and other developmental aspects on that. So we tried to make sure that people knew we had a long-term investment here, that we weren't just doing it transactionally, that, you know, we were going to be with you in the long haul, that we wanted to work as partners, that we wanted to, you know, recognize that aspect of it and keep a lighter touch on that, because we thought we were all heading in the same direction. If that turns out not to be the case, then when it comes time to reauthorize, there'll be a revisiting of it.
My question was, sorry, not...
I'm going to interrupt you, and I'm going to shift towards this side, and maybe one quick question. Please, no comments, just a simple question.
Sure. My question, Congressman Tierney, your presentation was wonderful, but I have a question about the Kerry Lugar bill and the Congress. Is there a way, or have they in this bill, or will they in the future be able to monitor the spending, especially as it pertains to the large for-profit aid and development agencies that often have seven layers of bureaucracy and middlemen before it makes it down to the ground? I run a small NGO in District Muzaffarabad for the last 4 years, and I've seen the evidence of how these monies get spent in a very inefficient way, and by the time it gets down to the ground, there's not much left for, you know, you've got Western salaries in D.C., you have debts and bills to pay, and all that money, some of it doesn't even reach Pakistan except on a sheet of paper.
You hit a great point. You hit a great point that we're dealing with not just in Pakistan but in Afghanistan as well. You know, the K Street rips off a certain percentage, then an analogous group in the local country rips off a certain percent. By the time it gets to the people, there's a diminished amount on that, and it's been a real problem for us. Since we took over the committee in 2007, we've tried to ratchet up the oversight. In fact, we found the coalition support funds, which was $6.7 billion, was basically unaccounted for. And that's what really started our committee on this path, is what the heck are we doing putting money over there if we can't tell once it gets into the Treasury whether it gets spent, goes into somebody's pocket, or moves off in another direction. So we're trying to, in the bill, in the Kerry Lugar bill, the provisions for inspectors general to specifically work in Pakistan, both the State Department and the USAID, and to focus on these types of issues. And there's strong language in there that the money is to get down to the local aspect as far as it can, and that the people to be put to work, whether they're engineers or designers or people with a shovel, that it be local people. One of the problems that I've seen, and I think a lot of us have seen, and the folks from my committee staff are over here too, work on that, is they're hiring people, but they're hiring people from other countries. So if I'm doing a project to build a bridge, I hire the engineers from France, I hire somebody else from Italy, and you know, there's local talent there. That's where the money should be going, both to build the capacity, you know, so that you have experience and you can go on to other projects or whatever, but also put people to work, put the money into the economy. And they should be. So I think it's great. And that's what we're looking for. We should look for people that are doing that kind of hiring and spending the money there, not taking a percentage off the top. So we've got the work here to be done locally, that we make sure that the State Department, USAID, who are seriously understaffed right now from years of neglect, that we bring more of that back in-house so the money's not going off to K Street, so that they're taking a share before it goes over, and then they're only sending it over there hiring in a similar situation. The other part that we have is with respect to the money that's going to be invested in the Northwest Frontier Province, in Fatah, that areas, it's very difficult to get any oversight at all there. It not only is it difficult for our people, American people, to get in there and see how these projects are going, sometimes it's difficult for Pakistanis from a different ethnicity or a different area to get in there. So how are we going to assure that that money is not being ripped off either by irresponsible contractors or by local people that are corrupt on that? So that's a real tough thing. We have to work with the government to try and make sure that we have some oversight and some ability to get in there and see that we're actually getting results. There's a school built. You know, who's building the school? It's going to stay up a lot longer if it's local people building it. And we want to make sure that it's done right. Then we have to get the teachers out there, because we have schools without teachers. It's been a difficulty, too. So it's a serious oversight challenge. We're going to do our best. We put the language in the statute, I think, that helps us get the inspectors, generals, and others to do it. But then our committee is just going to stay on it. And it's not a question of one hearing and out. As I said, we've had a dozen-plus hearings on this, and we've taken several trips over there. We'll continue to do it, because what you say is an incredibly important point. Thank you.
If I could just intervene.
Give a kind, if you would.
Sanjay, I know you've traveled a long distance to be here, and would you like to comment on any part of the discussion so far we've had? Because we want your thoughts also.
Well, again, it's a health panel. I'm surrounded by wonderful cardiologists, like the ambassador said. I did take my Lipitor, but besides that, I think what the congressman has done with the Education Assistance Amendment, whatever the perspectives are, I think it's a very, very relevant piece, because education will be the foundation of Pakistan. I truly believe so, and it's the foundation of any nation. And we should be fully supportive. Obviously, USAID has challenges in every country. It's not just in Pakistan. USAID, historically, as an agency, has problems. We don't have a USAID administrator even today, so for a variety of reasons. So putting that aside, there obviously are going to be issues, but I think the Congress has taken a first good step, and I commend you, Congressman, and the Senate. Obviously, for every decision, there's always going to be viewpoints, and there are different viewpoints on this, but I think for a nation like the United States, which is currently going through its own financial challenges, it is still the most generous nation in the world to go out and do something like this, because it truly believes in a strong partnership and a friendship. If you read the act, it talks about deep friendship and partnership with Pakistan. So I think the congressman and all the members of his Congress should be really applauded for what they have done. Is it 100% of what Pakistan wants? Well, if it was, then it would not be a perfect bill, because if everybody gets everything, it's not a perfect bill. But I think it's a great start, and Congressman, we really thank you for what you're doing.
So this is how we're going to conclude this. We'll have one question from each side that have to do with policy, and we will have a brief discussion, and then we will introduce the Minister of Prime Minister of Education, Ehsan Iqbal, and then we will thank our guests who have joined us from Pakistan. So go ahead and please, a very brief question from each side.
Do I go first? Okay, my name is Amtul. I'm from Kennedy School, and I would like to ask a question from Dr. Juma about the health policy he has given. And I feel like there is a kind of compartmentalization here, and no issues like drinking water, for example, or agriculture use of water has been discussed here. So how do you think it can compare with a holistic policy, including prevention, into what you are saying right now?
So, Dr. Juma, were you able to get the question?
Yes, I did. Thanks, Nazim. Amtul, thank you very much. Amtul, you know, before we actually put this policy out, as you often do in this process, we first reviewed all the policies that the Pakistan government had put out in the last 20-odd years. And there are four of them. And then we looked around to see, in discussion, we put together groups of people and put everything on the table. And in that mishmash were a number of items which do not figure in the Biden policy. And I can tell you, one of the important things in that, and even coming from my perspective, was water sanitation, because clearly it's at the heart of many of the health problems that afflict our children. But, you know, we made a judgment call that we wanted this policy to be focused and formatted in such a way that the objectives were achievable and would have important consequences. And that's why this focus on primary health care and a package of services. Can I just very quickly end by saying that the whole water and sanitation piece is a very important part of the agenda of the Ministry of Health and Ministry of Environment, and probably one of the few examples of an interministerial collaboration in Pakistan is that the two ministries have got together and set up a environmental health protection unit in our National Institute of Health in Islamabad just 6 or 8 weeks ago. And I hope that you'll be hearing more about their work in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Juma. One final question, policy related, very short.
And
let this question be directed towards the congressman, because he is about to be leaving.
It is. So the way we have this whole confusion about Kerry Lugar bill suggests that we need to have more dialogue. And so many American government officials go to Pakistan, but very few of them actually interact with the civil society, have meetings like this one. You know, go to universities or civil society or in the media. So I was wondering if you can sort of try to bring about that shift, that people who travel to Pakistan interact more with the civil society, and also to facilitate interaction in the other direction, bring about some improvement in the post 9/11 visa policy, because it's really made it hard, not just for Pakistanis and Muslims, but also for others. If you Google this, you will even find some Indians and other people getting affected. And you don't want the U.S. to lose its position as the primary destination for foreign brains. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the question he's asking is that as due to the war on terror and due to what happened on 9/11, there were visa restrictions put in, specifically countries that had people from countries from Islamic origin, or, for example, Pakistan. And that has impacted many people. And what is that the U.S. government is doing, and what are its policies?
Well, that's a good question. We've done, I think, somewhat better in the educational field. There was a while after 9/11 where people that we wanted to come in on education areas were actually being excluded, and that was not healthy for anybody. The security concerns took paramount precedence on a lot of things, but we weren't really handling it the right way. We've increased the number of students now coming in from foreign countries and got that back almost to normal stages. The State Department is working on those visas. We need to do a better job just generally. We still have the lists the lists are not accurate, a lot of false positives on that. I think that that is an area that we struggle with in terms of making sure that all of our agencies are working together and only putting people on the list that there's a solid foundation for a belief that they warrant being there. We are not unmindful of that. All I can say that might be helpful at all to you is that it's something constantly that several committees of Congress keep revisiting with the Department of State and others, Homeland Security and the Department of Defense as well, to try and make sure that we don't exclude people, that we have more contact rather than less. We talk about it all the time. Every time we have a policy with a foreign country, we talk about exchanges. We talk about the need to know more about different cultures. We've got to make sure that our policies, particularly with respect to visiting and immigration, reflect that so that we can get the benefit of it. I do want to just note that when we go to Pakistan, there's always that tension. The State Department always wants to make sure that everybody is protected, I think in many cases overprotected. So there's a constant tension between our staffs on the committee and others that are arranging the trips with the State Department to make sure that we do get out of the embassy, you do get out of whatever hotel you're staying in and move around. We've been able to get out to Peshawar, we've been out to Karachi, we've had meetings with people who've been fortunate, good to us to come all the way from different areas of Pakistan to where we were just to make sure we had those contacts. It doesn't always make the State Department happy because they're just so conscious of the security issue, but our job isn't complete unless we reach out beyond. We had this particular problem. I know Hassan will acknowledge that. When President Musharraf was there, there was a constant way of trying to send over American delegations. They would meet with the military, they would meet with the president, and then they would go home. They wouldn't meet with any of the other parties. And when we went over, we insisted on meeting with representatives of every party and the press. And I know that we were involved with talking to people from GEO and from other organizations because the press was in serious difficulty at the time, as with the judicial system. We went out and actually met Judge Chaudhry when he was in house arrest to make the point. I think we were the first ones from another country to get out there and make sure that we met with the judge to make the point that we thought that the judicial system was important and that we had to hear what was going on. We talked to the members of the bar associations and others. So that's critical, and we have to keep making that effort. I can tell you, for my subcommittee's respect, that anyway, we will continue to do that and make sure that we make that a part of every trip that we take. And I think that that's spreading through the other committees as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Due to prior commitments, Congressman has to leave. On behalf of Harvard University and Extension School, once again, I thank you, Mr. Congressman. Andre. Sir, if we can have a group photograph. We will actually continue our program for another 10 minutes because Dr. Anila and Mr. Puri has to speak, and after that we'll break for lunch. Once again, thank you.
So moving along, we had sort of interrupted our sequence. The next speaker that I wanted to introduce Dr. Anila Asghar. She is the assistant professor at the School of Education at the Johns Hopkins University. She has done her postdoctoral work at McGill. She has a Doctor of Education degree from Harvard University, where she also did her master's. She focuses on cognitive and emotional development, education reforms, science, religion, and culture. And developing scaffolded context for faculty development. Please welcome Dr. Asghar.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much for having me here. It's always very nice to be back at Harvard and, of course, in Boston. I'll try to condense my talk in the interest of time. Okay, so a society is judged by how it treats its weakest members, the disadvantaged, the oppressed, the dehumanized. In other words, the last, the least, the littlest. Many complex challenges confront our Pakistani society today. What role can education play in a society plagued by poverty, violence, political turmoil, and inequalities? The International Commission on Education for 21st Century highlights the ways in which educational policies can help to create a better world by contributing to sustainable human development, mutual understanding among peoples, and a renewal of practical democracy. How do we translate this into a framework for education reform in Pakistan for creating a peaceful, democratic, healthy, and just society? We are aware of the problems that confront education in Pakistan, so I'm not going to talk about them. I'm just going to very briefly summarize some of the issues that have confronted us for the past 60 years. The quality of education is deteriorating in public schools. Chronic underfunding of schools, coupled with an acute shortage of teachers, is affecting the quality negatively. Professional isolation of teachers' work makes it worse. Adequate teaching and learning resources are not available. Labs and libraries are ill-equipped. Classrooms are overcrowded, and curriculum has little relevance to students' lives and needs. That's a pretty bleak picture, but I have also had the honor of working in various very creative and stimulating projects, reform projects in Pakistan at all levels, including K through 12 and higher education. And that gives me a lot of work, a lot of hope, the work that I've done with people in Pakistan. Two different systems of education for the privileged and the disadvantaged students serve to reproduce the inequalities and existing injustices in the society. Education is perceived as a process of memorizing isolated facts and bits of information. Paulo Freire talks about the banking concept of education. He describes it as an education system where teachers tend to fill students' minds with information that is not connected to their existential experiences. Students memorize and repeat empty words and phrases without understanding the true importance of what they actually mean. Students are viewed and treated as mere containers waiting to be filled with disconnected facts and figures. The more completely the teacher fills the receptacles, the better teacher she or he is. Freire calls them as bank clerk teachers. The more meekly the containers permit themselves to be filled, the better students they are. Their test scores reflect how good they are at storing and regurgitating information. This process stifles their imagination, inventive thinking, and creativity. So what is our vision for 21st century education in Pakistan? Again, the International Commission on Education for 21st Century, in its report to UNESCO, points out that democracy appears to be progressing, taking forms and passing through stages that fit the situation in each country. Its vitality is nevertheless constantly threatened. Education for conscious and active citizenship must begin at school. We need an education system that addresses issues of tolerance, values, social, cultural, ethnic, and religious diversity, and encourages students to confront and critically examine sources of conflict, both actual and perceived, through exchange of ideas in a civilized manner. We are aware that education is a powerful tool for engaging with social and cultural diversity amongst various communities within a country. Although diversity is symbolically celebrated in Pakistan, its substance and rich regional nuances need to be developed substantively. Economic inequities across provinces tend to foster social and psychological distance. The aim for education should be to engage educators and students from all provinces in communication exchange and dialogue. A dialogue that gives them an opportunity of engaging themselves with the other and understanding and appreciating others' viewpoints. Such an approach will upgrade teachers' pedagogic skills, professional knowledge, and practice, highlighting areas of cultural and historical diversity as a basis for society's strength, healing, and regeneration. The quality of mathematics, science, engineering, and technology education needs to be raised at all levels also to promote scientific literacy, thinking, and reasonings. Students should be able to identify scientific and technological issues, explain phenomena scientifically, and use scientific evidence while constructing their arguments. The main purpose of science and mathematics education should enable them to engage in inductive and deductive reasoning, problem solving, systems-based thinking, and critical decision making. These competencies, concepts, and skills are required to understand the complex scientific, social, and political issues, and also, you know, health-related issues. I'm cutting it short. I'm now going to briefly share the relevant research on various innovative ideas, approaches, and experiments in education in many developing as well as developed countries. Although I cannot capture the specific issues involved in K through 12 and higher education, but most of these ideas apply to elementary, secondary, and higher education. And, you know, there are so many creative projects, as I said earlier, are going on in Pakistan. And the need is to identify the strengths of these programs, the successes, and then so that we can build on those programs. There is a strong need for rigorous evaluation research, both in the U.S. and in Pakistan, to look at the effectiveness of different education reform initiatives that are being implemented in both countries. Policymakers in developing countries have long been troubled by the undesirable but apparently unavoidable choice between providing broad access to education and developing high-quality schools. Recent evidence, however, suggests that this is not an appropriate way to think about human capital development. Grade repetition and high dropout rates lead to a significant waste of resources in many school systems. Education policy research in developing countries suggests that students respond positively to quality schools. So quality needs to be tied to access. Democracy and schooling. Schools should be the places where students should learn and experience, learn to, you know, live democratically and experience democracy in practice. Professional development of teachers, sustained, regular, ongoing professional development of teachers is key to success, and it has to again be coupled with rigorous research. And researchers over here, I've been working in this country and in Pakistan for many years, researchers in this country are also struggling to find ways to develop rigorous research to look at the effectiveness of different approaches to education. Parent involvement is also very important, and it has been positively correlated with student achievement. Later, I think in our discussions, we can talk about some of the creative projects that are being undertaken in Pakistan. For example, the public-private partnerships. The government of Pakistan has actually taken strong measures to encourage the spirit of collaboration between different public and private sector institutions in education. And we have the former Minister of Education with us. That's why I did not share with you any features of the education policy. I leave it to him. So thank you so much.
At this point, I would just thank our guests who had joined us from Pakistan, because we are going to be moving on to other topics. Dr. Juma, did you have any, how, are we disconnected? Did you have any parting thoughts?
No, Naveem, I think excellent event, and clearly, you know, somebody talked about bridge building, and clearly this is the sort of thing that leads to that. And I would encourage you and all the other APNA colleagues in America to do more and more of this, and we're always at your disposal.
Thank you again. So our final guest is Mr. Sanjay Puri. He's a recognized authority on U.S.-India relations. Mr. Puri is the chairman of the U.S.-India Political Action Committee, a national bipartisan political action committee representing over 2 million Indian Americans. He works with the members of Congress of both parties, as well as the administration, to ensure that community concerns are addressed. I am going to go ahead and let Sanjay take over.
Thank you, Dr. Afridi, and thank you all for having me, Ambassador. It's a real honor, and especially the esteemed panel. Hard to speak after a McGill and a Harvard PhD, and right before lunch. But so I'll keep it very brief. As I said, I came also to learn, so hopefully I'll get a few questions, criticisms, and I'm open for all suggestions, ideas, in every constructive way. You know, listening to this dialogue, obviously, it reminds me about a lot of what we started 8.5 years ago. And one thing I would definitely say is the Pakistan-American community definitely needs to get more active in public life. And public life doesn't always mean politics. It's just some of these kinds of forums, because we have done a lot of these. Because if you don't say or express an opinion, somebody else's, and it might not be your perspective. And also, you know, we have a joke in the Indian American community that when you grow up, there are only two choices, and I presume it applies to the Pakistani American community. It's to be a doctor or an engineer, as we see right here, surrounded by me. But you are starting to see a lot of Indian kids who are coming into politics and public life. You see that with Bobby Jindal, and you go across. I mean, we get, in the past 2 months, we've received two congressional requests and about 8 state requests. And I would encourage the Pakistani-American community, because it's not just important to support President Obama, but to also to have an Obama that's from your community. And those are things I think that we can collaborate, because just because a Pakistani-American candidate is running doesn't mean he's can't be supported by an Indian American, or Indian American candidate is running, it can't be supported by a Pakistani American. So I will leave that to you with thoughts, and I again thank you for having me. As I said, when Irfan called, and I obviously kudos to Irfan and his team for setting this thing up, because it's very, very important. I was wondering what was the point, but I came here more to learn, and I have learned, and hopefully I'll learn more before I go. Thank you so much.
Before we start the discussion, I'm going to have Ehsan Iqbal to come in and briefly tell us about you, the Minister of Education, previously. Please welcome Ehsan Iqbal, please.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen and distinguished guests. I have a second panel session, so I'll say more in detail then. But I, at that time, actually would have appreciated when Congressman Tierney was here, if I had the opportunity, I could have shared with him what are our concerns on Kari Lugar Bill. It's not that we are not very capable of reading English language. There are some, you know, concerns we have on Kari Lugar Bill as Pakistanis, and when I speak in the next session, I will now highlight them. But I'll just briefly say a few things on the social sector. I think one of the points made here is very true, that there is a correlation between any society's development and what it invests on social sectors. Unfortunately for us, one of the problems has been due to long rules of military dictators. Under every military dictator, the investment in social sector has gone down, and there has been a transfer of resources from social sectors towards the security areas. Military expenditure was increased, but the social sector expenditure was decreased. Whereas under democratic governments, we have seen that there was always greater allocation to social sectors. To just make a point, between 1988 to 1999, the 11 years when we had democratic regimes, even though those regimes worked under Pressler sanctions, there was no aid coming to Pakistan. Yet in education, there was an allocation, though it is still very low, about 2.2 to 2.4% of GDP. But under Musharraf era, when there was very liberal foreign aid coming, for 8 years of his rule, the expenditure on education came down from 2.2% to 1.8% of GDP on average. Similarly, on health, previously the expenditure was between 0.6 to 0.8% of GDP during earlier regimes, but under Musharraf regime, it dropped to 0.5 to 0.6% of GDP. So certainly that is an issue and we need to address. But what I would like to say, there are a number of challenges we are facing in education. One important point needs to be made. Pakistan needs reform, but the success of that reform will depend on the ownership of the reform in Pakistan. If that reform is seen as America-driven, there will always be suspicion, there will always be doubt, and I think it is very commendable that there is realization in the United States that the assistance to Pakistan has to be changed or has to be now diverted more towards non-military areas and particularly social sector development. But again, I would say it is very important that we do it in a way that there is greater ownership of the society and there is a greater collaboration to set out priorities and agenda. Also, one area which I think is very important, which you can really help, is help us determine how we can use new technologies and particularly information technology towards creating a wider impact in health and education sectors. Because we certainly have a lack of resources, but now new technologies, particularly ICT with information communication technology, you have the opportunity of telemedicine, you have the opportunity of tele-education, you have the opportunity of taking the best teachers and the best doctors from cities to rural areas through internet, through information technology. Now, those are the opportunities I think we need to see, that how can we develop models of leveraging scarce resources we have in the country and take them out to the vast rural population, which is still deprived of basic healthcare or good quality education facilities, which do not have good quality teachers. So how can we take the expertise of good teachers in the cities or in certain schools and leverage it to provide access to other children in far-flung areas? I understand some good models some people are taking initiative. In India also, I learned with information technology, they have taken some initiatives in these areas. And those could be areas of collaboration where we can look for solutions in the context of South Asia to have better governance for our people and to fight socio-economic underdevelopment. And I was really surprised and shocked to see that in the new Human Development Index, India ranks 134th and Pakistan ranks 141 out of 172 countries. We should admit that despite whatever claims of economic development we make, South Asia still is a mass of poverty, mass of underdevelopment, and unless this development goes out to all people across all divides and the more marginalized people, we cannot build an ivory tower of development on such a mass of poverty and illiteracy. And I think there we need to work together. How can we bring these dividends for our people with more collaboration and focusing on constructive issues rather than on issues of mutual destruction? I hope this conference will pave way for promoting that understanding. And I'll talk to you more in the next session. Thank you very much.